when you're not 100% aligned, and even if you're like 99% aligned, that 1% will erode you. You know, it'll be like a poison pill that will just eat away at you.
Welcome to Secret Ops, the podcast uncovering the world of operations one episode at a time. I'm your host, Ariana Caffone, and today's guest is Maxwell Nee, Chief Revenue Officer at Score App, a quiz marketing platform. In addition to being a Chief Revenue Officer, Maxwell is also a multi-award-winning entrepreneur. And what I found particularly fascinating about how he views business is that he's sat in almost every type of role in a business. He's been part of a team, he's been a leader of a team, and he's also started a business and led the team from that capacity. And each of those different roles has given him a lot of wisdom and a lot of different ways to look and approach business. You're currently Chief Revenue Officer and an entrepreneur. So what was the transition between both?
The way I fell into this Chief Revenue Officer opportunity was in my last business, we got up to doing about 200K, 250K a month. To sustain that, we needed a lot of leads and a lot of sales. It's basically just like a big sales machine. So we were always looking for a new edge and a new advantage on how to generate more highly qualified leads. And then one day, my friend Daniel Priestley, the founder of Score App, messaged me and said, "Hey, we made this new app called Score App. It uses quiz marketing. We're looking for some investors/partners. Would you like to invest?" So then I said, "Yes, holy crap!" You know, we actually had our own version that we Frankensteined using like Google Form, Google Sheets, and just sticking all these like seven different apps together. It took like 8 weeks and like 10,000. So I invested three times. I invested as an angel, two top up investments, and then just was like an advisor/partner for about 4 years, and then came into the team to help us expand into Asia Pacific because I live in Singapore.
I'm going through a similar transition where I was advising with the business and now I'm going internal into the business. And it's interesting because you have one aperture when you're advising and then you have a different aperture when you're actually in the role. What changes in how you view the business since you've gone from solely an investor to being within the everyday operations of the business?
I think of every business as the owner, you know. So I really think of everything as like a P&L, a profit and loss, because, you know, I've got my own money in this business, so I want to see it do well and I want a return on my investment. But also, you know, I love focusing on the tangible traction in a business. When I help out with a business, we negotiate my like a retainer or like a performance fee or something, right? And the first thing I ask for is like all the numbers so that I could make sure that I fit in without burdening the business. Because,
totally,
you know, I've worked in businesses before where I've owned them that have just fallen apart because the numbers weren't right. So I always try to be really respectful and aware and holistic in terms of, am I adding in a role that if anyone walked in, anyone could win? And the business could win, you know, not just, you know, something that works really well for me, but doesn't work really well for everyone else.
So I don't think that's everybody's mentality. How did you develop that mentality? Definitely not. I mean, that's a unique approach. I also feel similarly. I joke. I'm like, I've done my job if I automate myself, but that literally is my approach in how I view working with different businesses. Is it just having walked in the shoes of owning your own business that makes you approach it with that sensibility?
I think you need to lose money in a business or an investment to really always have a string tethered to that way of thinking. You look at things very differently. You don't look at things anymore in terms of, you know, we spend more, we make more, and just like more is more. You look at things the opposite, which is the actual strongest competitive advantage you could bring to anything is de-risking that operation, you know, and you know, burdening is risk. And, you know, if you could figure out a way to grow in like a new market and you've reduced the risk to almost zero, then that's genius. That is like operational genius.
Now, it's interesting because you obviously are very operationally focused. That's part of how you view business. But you also have to be forward thinking from a revenue standpoint, from a sales standpoint, from a lead standpoint. And most operators are not good at that part. So for those listening, what are some things that you've learned in that role that would be something we should put into our toolbox as operational leaders?
So let me speak from experience, right? So in my last business, we grew to $2 million a year in less than 2 years. So it was really fast growth. We started the business in COVID and we were in a very saturated industry. So, you know, what we did was like nothing short of a miracle. But the first miracle that happened that started the chain reaction of miracles was that there was three founders that met that were all totally aligned and we all fit three different boxes. Like there was a sales and marketing guy who was me. There was the service delivery guy, which is my other founder. And then we had a tech guy. So we didn't have to pay for any of those in terms of salaries. And we had really good chemistry. You know, like for example, I'll be getting married probably sometime next year. And both of those guys will be at my wedding. Right. So that's how like tight we are. So, and because of that experience, I've really learned that I only want to do business that way. When you're not 100% aligned, even if you're like 99% aligned, that 1% will erode you. You know, it'll be like a poison pill that will just eat away at you. So, you know, the right people in the right spots create magic no matter which environment. So, you know, there's the right people in the right team. And then there's also the alignment of where you want to go. We actually fell apart towards the end of that period, like really, really fast. And you could tell, you could feel it was coming and we were fighting it. We were just trying to win different sports. You know, one of them was trying to win like a marathon. The other one trying to win a sprint and I was trying to win like a triathlon. So one day we wrote down, what do we want? And all three of us wrote down a piece of paper. We didn't show it to each other. And we all showed it to each other at the end so that we wouldn't like influence each other. And then the first founder wrote, you know, I want just 20, 30K a month. That's all. But I want to be able to take holidays whenever I want. And then the next guy said, oh, you know, I want a $10 million business, but I want it to be like a machine. So he was like a worker bee. So he just needed consistency. He needed slow, steady growth, that type of thing. And then I wrote down, which I write the same thing down like every year in my like yearly goals. I at least want a $100 million business. Now, I don't care what the business is. Like, I don't care if I'm selling plates or if I am selling rockets. As long as it has big scale and I could walk back and look and see this mountain that I've helped to build, that's what excites me. But when everyone looked at each other's goals, the first thought was like, oh, crap, you know, we're going to fall apart. And this was actually quite early, so we didn't fall apart till about 2 years later. But you were constantly trying to pull the business in different directions. And as soon as we reached the first person's goal, which is like that 20, 30K a month type of thing, it fell apart like immediately because it was like the lowest common denominator.
It's very interesting because people don't understand how emotional owning a business is. You have to be pragmatic about so much of it, but also part of it is what do you personally want out of life and how does that translate into your business goals as well? There's a lot of introspection that you've had to do, I think. The advantage of interviewing people is to sort of hear what you're saying and then reflect back on my own experience and think, oh my God, I know that feeling, but I've never heard it described in that way. Have you learned this just from hitting those walls or... Have you had coaching? Like, how have you learned these things?
Yeah, a bit of everything, right? So my last business was a coaching business. So literally coached 1,000 people. Like I did 10,000 hours of coaching in like 5 years, like a mix of giving and receiving. So I really believe, like I watch Shark Tank a lot, right? And Shark Tank is just like entrepreneur after entrepreneur. You get to see a lot of the same, but you also get to see a lot of people doing different things. And the one thing that I noticed that really stuck out to me as a sore thumb is that the number one reason why entrepreneurs fail over a long term, or they don't grow over a long term, is a lack of self-awareness. You know, they'll have some like sports products, and you know, Mark Cuban owns the Dallas Mavericks, right? You know, this guy, he said, oh, I wanted to do this and this really works. And Mark said, have you thought about this? This is what I think would really work. And what Mark said was genius, and it was just like perfect feedback. And instead of taking Mark's feedback, he started defending why his way was better than Mark's. And at the same time, his business hadn't broken through 100K in revenue, right? And that 100K... That 100K revenue threshold is a very key milestone, because you can't fluke 100K. You could fluke maybe 10, 20, 30K, but you can't fluke 100K plus. You definitely can't fluke more than 200. So once you pass that threshold, you have worked something out. You found a supply and demand intersection in the world of commerce somewhere in the world, in the blue ocean of supply and demand, and you've worked out how to monetize that. And you've also, more importantly, you worked out how to monetize that beyond your personal network, because that's when real business starts. And Mark told him the same thing in three different ways, and he just wasn't getting it and he kept defending it. And then he basically turned Mark off. And I was like, dude, your problem isn't that you need 200K from Mark Cuban. Your problem is that you don't know how to listen to when an expert in the field is giving you feedback and you're arguing with him on TV.
That's the issue. The awareness is that first step that you talked about, having that moment of like, oh, I suck at this thing. I need to get better at this.
Yeah. And, you know, so I'm an investor now, right? And so investing is the opposite of an entrepreneur. They're like the ultimate optimist. They're like, no matter what the risk, whatever, I'm going to kick these doors down and I'm going to build this pyramid, right? Like I'm going to crack open this mountain. I'm going to crack open this mountain and mine all of the marble in this mountain. I'm going to build, you know, marble statues and make $1 trillion. Like, that's how an entrepreneur thinks. And I love that. And I love that energy. And it's cool and it's fun. But obviously, you know, it's a little bit insane, right? A lot of it doesn't make logical sense to a risk-reward ratio. And investors think all about risk-reward ratio. So the first thing that they think, the first filter that they put you through is, how could this not work? There's really high reward in being pessimistic as an investor, because that's how you not lose money. You constantly look at different angles of how it could not work. And if you're comfortable with those, or if you patch all those holes in the ship, then you're like, okay, this can work for me, type of thing. Mm. Operators are really good at it as well. You know, operators are good at like cutting the hair off problems, so that you've got like this perfect, you know, manicured apple or whatever, you know, thing ready to eat.
No, that's what it's hard to describe, because it's not about perfection, but typically when I come into operations, if they don't have an operator involved, it's like death by a thousand cuts. You have to solve the root of those things to get that machine working smoothly and oiled up, so that you can get it in a place where then you can start to really be creative. That's where I think the creative part comes in, is once you've got that machine and you know it inside and forward and backward, then you can start adding different things to it that don't exist in the world. That's the cool part, is when I see operations all of a sudden render something possible that wasn't possible before. And technology is like a huge key factor. I mean, even if we talk about Score app, you know, that was something I think people wanted for a long time, is to have some sort of assessment tool or quiz tool that would align with what they're doing. But like you said, you were sort of Frankensteining it together previously. And now you have these tools that you can plug and play that make what you creatively want to happen easier. Did you find in joining Score app, having Frankenstein a version of it, like, did it feel like, oh my God, sky's the limit now that we have a tool built for it?
Yeah. And you know, was the difference between Daniel building the tool and me not building the tool, because our businesses were pretty similar back then. The only difference was that he had the player on his team that was like the perfect web developer for this tool, who was like a co-founder and owner with him that he knew really well. So if my tech guy had that skill set, we would have built it, no questions asked. You know, totally. So I really believe in players in the team. You know, like I have another business where we build wind turbines, like renewable energy fans, mm-hmm. because the world needs more and more energy. And my sales pitch to anyone that has a solar panel is, what do you do at nighttime? and they say, yeah, you're right. You know, how much does your wind turbines cost? And so I've been sitting on a business idea like this for like years before I actually decided to do it. And the day I started to do it was when I found the perfect operating partner, actually. Mm-hmm. So he's an operating partner. He speaks, reads, and writes fluent Mandarin and Cantonese because a lot of our supply chain is in China. Mm-hmm. And yeah, I could translate it, but you know, that's just too hard, right? And he's a good friend and I can trust him. And, you know, I'd love to share equity with him in a company because we're just going to have so much fun together, you know? So, yeah. So that, you know, it sounds so simple. And I'm sure as a new business owner, you might just think, oh, Max, you know, you're talking like fluff, but no, it's true. Like if you aren't set up to win, like in terms of alignment and goals, and you aren't set up to have fun in your business, then it's just going to feel like you've just recreated corporate life for yourself, you know, all over again. Because then it's just like dating. You know, I
was exactly thinking that, Maxwell. I was like,
yeah,
finding that partner, man, it is, you go through a lot of duds. You go through a lot of duds. And then when you find the person, it's like a kismet feeling. It seems like you have found a lot of good partners along the way, though. How do you do that? Like, what's the magic behind finding those partnerships?
Yeah, so there's just like dating, right? So there's a lot of dating. There's a lot of ones that you just like, next, see you later, next. But the key thing that I think anyone can do in any operational outfit that very few people do it well, it's good, honest feedback that aligns with the self-awareness thing. So I'll give you an example. So when I was working with my three business partners, we had a promise within the business that you could give cold, hard, honest feedback. You could talk about your feelings. You could talk about how stressed you are. You could talk about everything. And you could do it in a judgment-free zone. So one day we did like a quarterly offsite where we met in person. And we went around the room and said, okay, well, what do we appreciate about each of us in the room? So all of them did me. We all did the next person. We all did the next person. We all did the next person. And then we said, okay, now, what do we hate, like lovingly hate, like hate in a fun way, about what the other person does, and what's one bit of feedback that we think the other person is dropping the ball on? Very, very few businesses, very, very few cultures are good at doing that. Mm-hmm. But you'll find the best businesses, the best cultures do that. And also, we did that in front of so we had a very flatline employee structure. We had 23 employees at one point, 23 team members. We did that on Zoom calls during our weekly meetings in front of all the other employees. And I did it for them. They did it for me.
Mm.
Owner to employee in front of 10 others. Because feedback is learning. And if keeping learning to a one-on-one, which is like very American and very Australian, then, you know, not everyone's picking up that learning. Right?
Totally.
But you have to be able to take it. And you have to be able to give it.
It's a muscle that I think a lot of people don't, like you said, a lot of people don't have it. We've all experienced it not done well. And so then you get scared because you've experienced a culture where maybe they want to have that like radical candor and that honesty, but they like don't, they just, it's more like shitting on you. And it's not the same thing. It's not the same thing. I also had that experience of joining a team where every action had a feedback debrief on it. So we'd get off a client call and then be like, okay, what did we do well? What could we have done better? I think you could have done this. And initially I was exhausted. Like I was like, whoa, like this is like a whole other layer on top of the work layer because I'm having to look inward and be self-reflective on top of learning the job. Mm. Like, geez, like this is a lot. But what does that do? It creates a really tight-knit team. I believe also it helps individuals to become more confident in their gut on things and to be able to speak up.
And tying all this back together, this magic is what makes ScoreApp special, So, you know, the slogan for ScoreUp is more data, more sales, right? And data is everything. Personalization is everything. Segmentation is everything. Whether it's for existing clients, whether it's for new lead generation, you want to know as much as possible about your audience and what they're interested in, what they're not, so that you can tailor to them. Because if you want to know how to optimize operations, if you want to know how to optimize sales, guess what? Your market, your audience, if you just listen to them properly, they have all the answers because you're in the business of serving them. My business partner wrote this book. It's called Scorecard Marketing. It's a best-selling book on Amazon. I actually read the audio. So if you download on Audible, you'll listen to my voice. So the book is about quiz marketing, why it works. So there's two parts to it. The first part is what it is and why it works. The second part is, you know, how to implement. Because without implementation, nothing happens. So, you know, one of the really cool chapters in the book is we talk about how to generate demand. Imagine like a pyramid, and in the pyramid, the top 3% of your pyramid is ready to buy now. But the issue with going after them is that they've typically decided who they're going to buy from. So the trick in business is to actually go for the market that's not ready to buy now. So that's the next layer. So that layer is about 7%. So when you go from 3% to 7%, you actually triple your market size, and you're actually increasing your conversion. But your conversion just won't happen that day. It'll happen, like, let's say, over the next 6 months. So long story short, if you think more long term about your leads, if you're thinking about planting more seeds in new opportunities rather than just harvesting, you want to know who's a seed, where you should plant. And that's what ScoreUp is really good at doing.
Maxwell, I know that you also have an incredibly generous offer for listeners if they're interested.
Yes. So we have this book called Scorecard Marketing, and we have a bunch of free copies. If not, you get a PDF copy that we can get out to you 100% for free. And all you need to do is go to ScoreApp, ScoreApp.com, and we'll get that out to you.
Amazing. I'll also put that in the description of the episode. So if you're interested, definitely reach out. And thank you so much for that generous offer. I cannot believe that the time has flown by, and it is time for us to wrap up for this episode. Maxwell, thank you so much for your time. I did want to leave off with adding in a couple of rapid fire questions to learn more about you on a human level. So the first question is, what is the favorite part of your day?
Favorite part of my day is just after the gym. So I wake up, go to the gym, and I'll sit at the cafe and then just sit with my notepad and just think about what's the next thing I could do. But also, how I could just keep my battery fully charged and keep my cup full.
What is the best purchase you've made under $50?
So I bought these headphones. It's like this no-name China brand, like a no-name China website. And I've got, you know, AirPods and all that type of stuff. But these headphones, they're better sound, better battery. You know, they were like $19 type of thing. And this is my second pair of the same headphones because they only last about a year. But I just thought, you know, I'll just buy a new one every year. And it's super robust. So when you're not using it, it just sort of hangs on your ear. And I fly a lot. So I always fall asleep like with my headphones. I would lose my AirPods as I fell asleep.
Yeah,
so,
I've done that so many times.
Yeah, game
that
changer.
That would be the one. What is something that makes you little kid happy?
So I work from home, and my future wife and our daughter come home at the same time. And when they come home, you know, they're exhausted from like school and work, and they come home after a long day. And I'm like the dog that is waiting at the door wagging its tail when they come home. And I bring all this energy, and they're just like, oh, yeah, they put their bag down, you know. And I'm like, oh yeah, that's right. You know, they need a second to recharge.
I love that.
I'm like a dog that's jumping on them, but they're not ready for me yet. Yeah.
The last question I have for you is, what is do you want to be when you grow up?
So I've always had this opinion of myself that I could always be more. I always wanted to be more like disciplined. I always picture like this old sensei, Japanese craftsman that's making swords. And he just does that every single day. He does it with such mastery. And he's just like this like Yoda of like sword making. And I've always wanted to be more like that. I think I am like that to an extent, but there's always more. And there's always like the next level, which is like the Japanese sword master level in my head. So I want to be more like that.
It's a beautiful way to end this episode. Maxwell, thank you so much for giving us your knowledge and your time. Also for that super generous offer. We'll make sure to put that in the description. If people are listening and they want to see more of what you're doing, where is the best place to point them?
Yeah, so I'm addicted to LinkedIn. So you always find me on LinkedIn. So message me there.
Fantastic. Thank you again, Secret Ops listeners. Thank you so much for listening. Remember, subscribe wherever you find your podcast. We're also on YouTube now, and we will see you next time.